Now to another In Country Today series of profile interviews with leaders and innovators in agriculture. And one of Australia's best known economists, Ross Garnaut, is our special guest today. He recently released his latest book, The Superpower Transformation, Making Australia's Zero Carbon Future. It's a very positive guide to how Australia can utilise our rich resources in renewable energy and capture carbon in the landscape. We'll look more deeply into that in a moment. Ross Garnaut, firstly, welcome to Country Today.
Hello, Libby. Good to be with you.
Now, you've had a stellar career as a government advisor, policymaker, international diplomat, including principal advisor to Prime Minister Bob Hawke, then ambassador to China. Now, you've also chaired the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research. So, shall we say you know your way around agriculture and its foibles?
Yeah, ACR, Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, a great institution. Been going now since the 70s, and it undertakes research jointly with people with similar interests in developing countries, mostly in Australia's neighbourhood, Asia and the Pacific, and it's done terrific work to assist development in communities in which agriculture is important in Australia. But that's also been important for us in Asia, but also been very important in Australia in feeding back insights that have helped our industry. I followed that with a period as chairman of the International Food Policy Research Institute based in Washington, which had a global role. That was really interesting in opening my eyes to some of the challenges of development across the world as a whole. And it was really there in the first decade of this century that I was alerted to how dealing with climate change was essential for future food security because it was so important to stable agricultural production.
Well, let's now move to climate change. You conducted a review on climate change policy for all the federal, state, territory governments released in 2008. It was commissioned by the states and opposition leader Kevin Rudd. He was then elected Prime Minister, though he didn't manage to adopt your recommendations as policy.
Yeah, not all of them. The government adopted the policies and put legislation through the House of Representatives, passed it through the House of Representatives, but of course nothing becomes law unless it's got support in the Senate as well. And at the time of my review, the time of the work, I had a lot of support from the federal opposition. It was then led by Malcolm Turnbull. I used to meet regularly with front benchers from the Liberal and National parties. And the opposition had said that it would support the legislation for carbon pricing, establishment of Australian Renewable Energy Agency, a number of other important institutions. But just in the month the legislation was to go to the Senate, after being passed by the House of Representatives, Tony Abbott made that the issue on which he defeated Malcolm Turnbull by a single vote in the Liberal Party room. And the opposition under Abbott caused the rejection of the legislation in the Senate. So we didn't get there with the Rudd government. Then after the 2010 election, the hung parliament, I was asked to update my report. And this time, the government, although it was a minority government in the House of Representatives, was able to get a majority in both the Reps and the Senate for passing legislation. And so we had the full suite of my recommendations working for a couple of years: carbon pricing, Australian Renewable Energy Agency, Clean Energy Finance Corporation, Climate Change Authority. We still had the renewable energy target working as legislated by Rudd back in 2011. So things were going very well for a while, and we were starting to see the emergence of some of the new industries in agriculture. We're seeing quite a lot of activity in planting. For example, in the Mallee country, in the wheat belt of WA, we're getting lots of plantings of Mallee in expectation of getting rewards from selling carbon credits. But of course, that only lasted 2 years. Worked very well for 2 years, very nice for farmers, but it was repealed by the Abbott government. And so we were left without the carbon price. But fortunately, other elements of the package endured. The Carbon Farming Initiative continued to provide some market for carbon credits from farming. Renewable Energy Agency continued. Clean Energy Finance Corporation continued. Renewable Energy Target continued, but in a cutback form. And the Carbon Farming Initiative had been part of the original Gillard government package. It would have had a lot more resources if we'd kept carbon pricing, because farmers could sell their credits into a very strong market because companies that had to pay a carbon price could avoid that if they bought credits from farmers. But Abbott stopped that by stopping the carbon price. And so the only way to sell credits was for farmers to sell them to the government, and that was a much smaller market than it would have been. But we're getting back to that world now with the new safeguard mechanism, which will expand the market for credit. So it was a long detour after the abolition of carbon pricing in 2014, but we're getting back to some elements of that system now.
Okay, well, let's fast forward to your latest book, The Superpower Transformation, Making Australia's Zero Carbon Future. Now, the first thing that struck me was your scathing criticism of, as you've just mentioned, Tony Abbott and then Scott Morrison's modelling and analysis to the COP26 Congress in Glasgow. You described it as a fraud, but you revealed that the Biden administration was furious and had far stronger language.
Yes, in fact, I want my book to be read by families, and I couldn't print the language from the high levels of the Biden administration. They were furious and used some language that I don't approve of, but it made it clear how strong their feeling was. Yeah, we put ourselves right out on a limb against our allies, against America, against Europe, against Japan, against all of our major strategic and political partners. We formed a sort of alliance with Saudi Arabia and Brazil and Russia and the countries that didn't want to do much on climate change. So it was a really sad episode, sad for Australian foreign policy, sad for Australian use of a great economic opportunity, especially for rural Australia. But fortunately, it's passed. I describe what happened then in the book, but I wanted to stand there not as a continuing critique of things past, but as a bit of a lesson on how costly it can be if you get things wrong.
You say we need five policy shifts. Can you put simply what they are?
Yeah, in the long term, we need carbon pricing again. But given the history, given the way the Abbott government and its successors, sadly, even Malcolm Turnbull, who generally is in a good place on these issues, but he was constrained by by his partners in government at the time, and then the Morrison government. It's really become politically impossible to go quickly back to carbon pricing. So I suggest in the book that we aim to get back there some distant time in the future, like 2035, so that it's not immediately a contentious issue, and so by the time it comes back on the agenda, the people who were so resistant to good science and good economics will be dead or enfeebled, and Australians of the future can discuss these issues in a sober and responsible way. Second thing is you need steady and consistent support for innovation. Building the new economies requires high levels of innovation. And anyone who does a new thing creates a lot of knowledge that everyone benefits from, but also makes mistakes that are costly. And so we want to encourage innovation. We want to encourage the new things. Some systematic support, fiscal support for investment in new things in the zero emissions economy is warranted. We've got an institution that does that for renewable energy called the Australian Renewable Energy Agency. I suggest in the book it could be given a wider role in relation to zero emissions industry as well. We're going to require a lot of reform and regulatory adjustment to make the most of carbon farming. It's potentially a huge industry, a big advantage for Australia that we've got so much land that's amenable to growing biomass as a base for zero emissions chemical industries, but also for storing carbon in the landscape. It could be a huge industry for us, but we've got to strengthen the regulatory systems that provide credits for what we're doing in the rural sector. The Chubb review that came out beginning of January is a step forward. It doesn't get us all the way there, but it's a step forward, and I think that we can strengthen that over time. We also need very good trade relations with the countries that are potentially big markets for zero emissions goods and carbon credits. Most importantly, they're the countries of Northeast Asia, our traditional markets for so many products, China, Japan, Korea, and also Europe. These countries have very poor renewable energy resources relative to population and few opportunities for sustainably growing biomass and growing carbon credits. They're going to need a lot of support through trade to achieve their decarbonisation goals, and Australia exporting a lot of zero emissions products to them is going to be very important. And if we're not seen by them at getting on with the job of decarbonisation, our products won't be allowed into their market from 2026. The Europeans will have a tax on imports that embody emissions, and wise Australian farmers and exporters of rural produce are recognising that they've got to get the carbon out of their supply chain so that we can continue to have access to those high price, high value markets in Europe. And we've got to put a lot of effort into planning at federal, state, and local level for the new industry, the new economy. And that will involve, amongst other things, a lot of investment in skills and education. Much of the new opportunity is going to be in rural Australia. This is going to change the balance between rural and provincial Australia and the old metropolitan areas, change the balance in favour of rural and provincial Australia. It's a big change. For that to work properly, we need good urban planning in rural areas, good regulation of the new industry. We don't want new environmental problems to arise, or problems in relations with established settler communities or First Nations communities. For change on this scale, we've got to recognise there's a big job in policy development, planning at all levels of government. So the agenda is a big one. But the prize is so big that it's worth making the necessary effort.
And most importantly, in the book, you and your co-contributors argue that it'll be good for jobs, for the economy, and significantly, Ross, for communities that have been built on gas and coal. I wonder if your study on Barcaldine in Queensland is a good example to illustrate what you're saying.
Yes, through my business interests, we're involved in looking at those opportunities in Barcaldine, and we think the combination there of reasonably good transport infrastructure. It's at the crossroads of to North and South Queensland, East and West, and on the main central highway. You've got access to water, which is becoming better because of the better management of the Great Artesian Basin. So modest amounts of water, the necessary amounts, can be made available responsibly to new industry. You've got a community that's very supportive of the new industry. And across the Tropic of Capricorn, and Barcaldine's right on the Tropic, we've got the best solar country in Australia, equal best in the world. Once you're a few hundred kilometres inland on the east and west coast, you don't get better solar than that. And in the slopes of the Great Divide, the Western Slopes, you've got a very good wind resource. You get pretty good winds right across those plains, but when it hits the rise of the beginning of the Great Divide, it gets better still. And you've also got a lot of land that can be made available for growing biomass and sequestering carbon. We think of that as ignorant Australians think of it as arid country, but average rainfall is not all that low. So you've got to make good use of native Australian plants that are adapted to hot and variable climates, but do that, and there's a lot of value in growing plants for producing industrial raw materials and for sequestering carbon in the landscape. So all of those advantages together add up to a pretty good opportunity. Lots of parts of Australia in different combinations have these sorts of advantages, and that's why rural and provincial Australia is going to be the heartland of the new zero emissions economy. The growth of the economy is going to be disproportionately in rural and provincial Australia, and Barcaldine is an example of what can happen.
And finally, as you are at pains to point out, and I think as most farmers are well aware, if we don't reduce global emissions, Australia is one of the countries with the most to lose.
Something that I emphasized in my first report way back in 2008, but when you look carefully at the evidence, we're tremendously vulnerable in two sorts of ways. So we're already a hot country that's at the margins of adequacy of moisture for agriculture. given the evaporation, given the variability of and relatively low average rainfall. So that if you change the climate, you increase the vulnerability more than you do in other countries because we're close to the margins already. And the second reason is that Australia is located in a region of developing countries which will find it very hard to adapt to climate change. The Netherlands has been building seawalls for hundreds of years to keep out the sea. Well, that's because it's been a rich country. A poor developing country won't be able to do that. And a lot of the populations of South Asia and Southeast Asia are very vulnerable to climate change. There'll be a lot of displaced people. We're the only developed country that lives mainly in a region of developing countries. And that's going to be difficult for us in terms of managing political relations with countries that have been destabilized by climate change. And also, developing countries are our, in the Asian region, are our main trading partners. That's not the case with other developed countries. So we're very vulnerable to any disruption of their economies because we won't be exporting as much for them. So they're amongst the reasons why Australia has a very powerful interest in the world dealing with this problem. It's a great relief to Australia that the world community has set upon an objective of holding temperature increases at 1.5 degrees below the pre-industrial level. We're already over 1.1, heading towards 1.2 on average in the world as a whole. Get very dangerous if it gets above that 1.5. Australia, more than any other developed country, has got an interest in making that policies of sticking to within 1.5 work. What we do matters. Us supplying low emissions goods, industrial raw materials, agricultural raw materials, farm products with, made with low emissions to Northeast Asia and Europe can help them in their decarbonisation. Of course, it's not only farm products, but other processing of minerals, which is mainly in rural Australia. So what is a great economic benefit to rural and provincial Australia can be a great help to the rest of the world in getting rid of carbon and dealing with the problem of climate change.
Well, on that note, we'll leave it there. Ross Garnaut, the author of The Superpower Transformation, Making Australia's Zero Carbon Future, published by La Trobe University Press. This is Country Today.